This is take two, side B of the interview with Peter McCulloch. We're resuming on the 17th of November 1992 in his office at JCSMR. And we were going to start talking, Peter, about your involvement in activities right across the university, or your exposure, so to speak, to university activities generally. When did you first become involved in the university beyond the school?
It would have been early, some stage, I think pretty early in 74, when I went on the council as a non-professorial representative from the institute.
Why did you choose to go on the council? Why did you stand for election, as presumably you did?
I guess I was persuaded to, because I'd been on the faculty board here for a year, so I was the first person actually on the faculty board who wasn't a tenured staff member, and it sort of started to sort of get stuck into things there. So I hadn't thought of the idea of getting on the council, but some of the people here said, well, how about going on? So I gave that a go. It may have been late 73 or early 74. It was about that period, because the new Vice-Chancellor, Dr. Williams, had taken office just about the time, slightly before the time that I started in the council.
Were there particular issues that you thought should be pursued on council?
I think basically my idea was the same, although probably not as crystallised as it was in the more recent term on council, which was getting on to represent the interests of the school and the medical research at the ANU in general. But the issues that, there are two, I guess, issues that came up or that I was involved with that I can recall now. One, of course, was this is the period when the ANU students were gradually doing what students in other universities had done some years before. We had quite a substantial sit-in at one of the council meetings and occupation of the chancellery, so-called, and at the same time we had the Vice-Chancellor Williams resigned precipitately in the second year of his term, and I was on the electoral committee which selected his replacement, which is arguably, I'd think, the most disrupted electoral committee it's the most disrupted electoral committee I know of in the period since I've been at the university here. I guess there may have been others that you don't hear of. This one was particularly disrupted because the proceedings were being published in the Canberra Times each morning after we'd finished an evening meeting. And it was the committee was very much under pressure for this reason. I suspect, although I don't know this, that the preceding committee that appointed Williams was under similar pressure. I know at that stage that the Chancellor, Nugget Coombs, was out of the country when the Williams appointment was made, and there was said to be a lot of pressure from people, come on, get an appointment up and running, and I think probably that that was a fairly precipitate appointment too. Well, not this one. The one that I was on wasn't precipitate. It was just that the committee was being fairly heavily harassed throughout the process.
So there was a leak on the committee?
There was a leak on the committee, which the person who was leaking, the large majority of the community thought it was the student, who it wasn't. I worked out who the leak was earlier probably than most other people, by the simple expedient of talking to the person who was the general staff representative, Norman Ainsworth, on the council. I remember talking with him after one of the meetings, after we'd been in the Canberra Times two or three times. I made up some cock and bull story about Peter Carmel coming across from Flinders and being talked to, and of course this was something that the committee hadn't been told yet, but that was going to come up, and of course this was totally fictitious, but it came in the Canberra Times the next day, so I said, well, that's good enough for me.
You must have suspected him. You obviously suspected him.
I didn't suspect the student. I thought the student was, the student was wild and a bit crazy, but I didn't think the student was doing it. And I didn't think the student was quite dopey enough to do it. The way it was occurring, the electoral committee itself was a real eye-opener, because I was still very impressionable at that stage, I guess. The couple of occasions the committee met actually from 9 in the morning until we were there at 6 o'clock. I can remember Arthur Cox serving us drinks after 5, and we were there just for the full day. And the Chancellor and Pro-Chancellor at that stage, you may have talked with the Pro-Chancellor, it was Tony Mason. It was Nugget Coombs as Chancellor, and Tony Mason was the Pro-Chancellor. He's on the High Court now. And it would be fair to say that they're both very competent chairmen, but they had fairly different aspects on life, I guess, in the sense that Mason you would regard as a fairly conservative type of approach to things politically and all other ways, and Nugget Coombs you'd regard as a fairly fairly non-conservative sort of person, although he has worked in the system most of his career. And we had this Cox and Box arrangement that we'd have a full day meeting, and Nugget would have to go off to help run the country or hold the Prime Minister's hand, and so Tony Mason would come in and take over the chair, and then Tony Mason would have to race up. He was on the High Court at that stage, but not Chief Justice, and do something. And I used to be horrified by the way the discussion would swing from one direction to another. It was like a ship tacking up Port Phillip Bay, because the two candidates it came down to would be Tony Lowe and Noel Dunbar. And Noel Dunbar would be regarded as a conservative sort of candidate. He'd been deputy vice-chancellor here and very bluff, straight, sort of what you see is what you get sort of person. Tony Lowe had been in Pacific studies earlier on, was known at the university here, and had come back as head of a research, well, come back in fact to be interviewed for vice-chancellor on the preceding occasion, had been slotted into the research school of Pacific studies with only one or two people knowing in advance. You've probably come across that. But
knowing in advance?
That he was under consideration.
For as vice-chancellor?
No, for head of the research school. You probably copped. I mean, he came out to be interviewed for one, and clearly the other committee was called together at half a day or a day and a half notice and sort of said, well, you've missed on that one, but we have this one available. And as I remember it very well, all hell broke loose in the research school because no one knew. Oscar Spate, I understand, did know, although he didn't. He was the outgoing director, didn't acknowledge that. But people were horrified because they'd been, not necessarily by who it was, but by the fact that there'd been no consultation. That to Lowe's credit, by the time he came to be considered for vice-chancellor again, the 18 months later, we got a lot of support for him from the PAC-S, but also a lot of those saying, well, he's been terrific here and we'd really prefer to keep him. So that he went into a very unfavourable situation and did very well there. That people really thought he was a good thing by the time he came to go. Anyhow, the shortlist resolved down to these two people that are fairly, it was evident, I think, from a fairly early stage, but eventually resolved down to these two. And my impression was very much that Nugget was pushing for Tony Lowe, and that Tony Mason was a bit harder to read, but I suspect was more, certainly when he was in the chair, it swung back towards the other person, Noel Dunbar, more that way. And one learns an enormous amount watching Nugget chair that sort of committee when he was there, because he'd go around the table, you'd get everyone to disclose their views on this or that person, but holding back himself and then sort of directing. He's a terrific person. He's a thorough gentleman, but absolutely tie you in knots at a meeting and get exactly what he wanted, and you'd still think he was a great gentleman. Really terrific style and that, but he certainly knew how to run something. What happened was that the meetings would a number of the meetings went into the evening, and the Canberra Times would carry a report the next morning before Bill Hamilton, who was registrar, who was servicing the committee, could actually write up his notes. He'd get in the morning quite frustrated because he still had his shorthand and his notes here, and the Canberra Times had a 3-column account of what went on at the preceding day's meeting. And I think that process of leaking from the committee had quite an adverse effect on the people's thinking in the university for quite a while after that. I think it may still apply now. Apparently, I wasn't there, but I've heard second or third hand that the current committee meeting to appoint the vice chancellor there, still echoes of the fact that people think it was the students who were leaking, and the students have been excluded from this committee at the moment. Unless the change at for last Friday's meeting, they were agitating to have a wider committee, but it left an impression around for quite a while, and the actual nature of where the leak was going. I think Ainsworth was leaking just out of a fairly childish anarchist sort of conviction that these things shouldn't be kept secret, that they had to be put out in the open. But of course it has, whenever you do that, it has a fair impact on the way the process is going. It wouldn't have, I guess, had much effect on the two people who were more or less internal candidates or local candidates. I think it probably had some effect on others because names were being put out, names were mentioned of someone who people in other places, in other jobs outside ANU, once their name was mentioned, they sort of tended to sort of say, well, bugger that, I'd thank you not to consider my name anymore because I don't want it published in the Canberra Times the next day.
Were you on council at the time of the troubles, the worst of the troubles?
The student troubles, yes, sure. The troubles, as I recall, were sort of a fairly pale imitation of what had already occurred in sort of Europe and then around most of the other Australian universities in the preceding years. That we certainly weren't the first in by any means. And I think it was just, to be really cynical, that you almost felt that it was the ANU students showing, well, they had to do something, they had to be show that they were red-blooded, whatever. Because they came quite late and it was fairly unoriginal and wasn't very impressive. But we had the Chancery was occupied on one occasion and occupied for the meeting. The centre of the Mills Room absolutely chock full of students with us sitting around. It was the sort of day you hoped you had matching socks on and you'd clean your shoes because there were about 50 students sitting at foot level. I don't recall much else specific about the troubles. I think they were just the sort of that ANU students had to show that they were socially aware and were up with the times. It certainly, there's no way you could present what happened at ANU as leading or influencing other places. I believe it was very much a me too sort of response.
Do you think it had a long-term impact on university administration or the way the university worked generally?
I wouldn't have thought so, no. Because, I mean, there's been I think anyone dealing with the students, or particularly the undergraduates, is used to sort of you go through hectic periods. Well, the Union Board of Management's a good example, which every 10 years or so erupts like Vesuvius, and then 12 months later the changes, and so it sort of calms down like Vesuvius. No, I really don't think it had much long-term influence at all.
Mm. Just going back to what we were talking about before we switched the tape on, the appointment of the Vice-Chancellor Williams.
Right.
You were actually on that.
I was on the committee. Not the committee that appointed him. I was on the one that appointed Tony Lowe.
Yes. So you arrived on council just at the time.
Just as Williams came, and he was there for a fairly short period. I remember Colin Plowman left and went off to become. First of all, went off to the Arts Council of New South Wales, of which Nugget Coombs was the patron or chairman at that stage. Seemed to be a bit of placement influence involved there. And then went on to be Registrar of University of New South Wales. Then, of course, as soon as, within a few months of Tony Lowe coming in, Tony Lowe got Colin back as Assistant Vice-Chancellor, and the reason he gave was to help deal with the students. So clearly there was still, when he came in, there was still perceived to be a trouble. I mean, I think he probably could have dealt with the students very adequately himself because he carried on, made a point of still giving a lecturing unit that he'd done before he became Vice-Chancellor, and he went out of his way. He's certainly, whatever other faults he had, you could never accuse. He would be the most communicative vice chancellor there's been here. He was around the place, he turned up everywhere. And well, you might have were you at the over at the joint skills with?
No,
he really made a big effort to be seen, so that everyone knew him, and he was here, and he was there, and he came around. Whereas most of his successors, and well, I can't say much about his predecessors, but his successors tended to stay in the fortress chancellery.
Do you think Lowe was trying to counter the effects of his predecessor, his immediate predecessor?
I think he may have been, but I think he also recognised that there was a very substantial role for vice, that if a vice chancellor sat down and sort of just said, "Well, bring all the work has to be done across my desk," well, there wouldn't be. You'd need a 60-hour day, and you probably wouldn't do it all that well then. So I think he adopted the idea of getting out and putting more into the role of the vice chancellor, being seen and being known. And I mean, his wife was extremely good. We shouldn't leave too much on the tape, but by and large, most of the vice-chancellors I've known, their wives have beaten the vice-chancellor in terms of contribution to the university. And his wife was outstanding there, that she was, Belle was sort of organising this and organising that and really, you know, throwing it up into everything. I mean, Rosemary Nichols the same, but I think the wives often have made more contribution to the university than the husband.
Well, if there's a book on Prime Minister's
Wives. Yes. But I mean, that was the pattern when he went into the Pacific studies, because I know one thing I heard about, which I was particularly impressed by, that as soon as he got in there, and he, as I say, he went in under fairly difficult circumstances because of the way the appointment had been pretty rushed. He had every individual along at some stage. I think usually he just got his secretary to fill up the book, and they came along and had sandwiches with him at lunchtime, one by one, to tell him what they were doing and what they were after. And which I always thought that if one was coming in as a director to any research school, regardless of where you came from, that would be the, you would find it hard to go wrong. Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, communication, at least you are, people know who you are, and they've had a chance to tell you their grievances and that, and that is sadly almost totally lacking at both vice-chancellor and directorial levels, I think, around the university in most occasions.
Mm. Do you think there was a common expectation on council of what the role of a vice-chancellor ought to be, or did each individual member of council have quite different views?
I certainly don't think there was any common expectation. I mean, you start out with the job description, and it's fairly, the people at your first meeting, you prepare a job description that's fairly obvious pretty early on, that the person with all those attributes just doesn't exist. And the other thing, which is I think probably people have, it would be fairly apparent on lots of these committees, is that very frequently the people you want don't want to move, and the people who want to come are not the ones you want. But it's more often than not a case. I'm sure that may well be the case with the present committee, that you really you get a series of applications and you sort of say, well, yeah, they're interesting, but now none of the ones who really wanted to access are on that. The person who Peter Carmel at that stage was being, I think there was quite a view that, a very strong view on the committee, that it would be good to be able to get him, which at that stage he would have been at Flinders still. But that didn't proceed very far. And so I think it came down pretty fast to a choice between Tony Lowe and Noel Dunbar, and this feedback coming in. The students, that's right, the students were very, may have been damaging to Dunbar at that stage, because having been Deputy Vice-Chancellor, there was a lot of graffiti, anti-Dunbar graffiti around the place. I can remember the Mad Dog Dunbar painted across the wall on the bridge at the Union there. And that's, so that, obviously the person coming in who's been dealing with the students is coming in under a fairly heavy burden that I can't remember in detail, but I suspect that there was fairly strong student opposition to appointing him at stage. There were other people. I mean, we had interviewed. Helen Hughes was brought back for interview, who I didn't think on paper, I hadn't met her previously, it looked to me very suitable. And in fact, I was sweating a bit. I thought, I guess she's going to come back and the students will think she's what the ideal candidate. And interestingly, she came and talked with them, and the students, after about half an hour, sort of said, no way.
Who else? So the student influence was really quite significant.
Oh, yes. Yeah, no, they... I mean, I think they were spot on. But she... I was a bit apprehensive that she'd go down well with them. What other name? Oh, Joseph Needham came up, that's right. I remember that I was accused of being ageist for the first time I'd heard the word. Liz Reed, who was on the committee, is the one of the convocation people, I guess, put up Joseph Needham. Why can't we approach Joseph Needham? I said, he must be at least 70. And she said, that's ageism, and ageism is worse than sexism. Shut up for the rest of the meeting, boy. Yeah, I mean, you get every name under the sun, and the a lot of the ones that are suggested people are people who are in positions where they'd be very difficult for them to come in here. You'd virtually have to offer them an invitation before anyone knew anything about it, so it's not really, wasn't really on. But I forget, you'll have the minutes on these things, I forget the amount of detail of approach that went into Carmel. It was fair. I think he would have been. They would have jumped if it was an indication that he could.
So your leap to Ainsworth preceded.
I mean, well, Carmel was on the list of about, along with Joseph Needham and everyone else. Yeah. That sort of names. I think he was probably a fairly prominent vice chancellor name, probably the most prominent one in the country at that stage.
And to what extent did you achieve what you set out to do? If you'd gone on council to represent the interests of medical science and so on within the university, do you think council provided an effective venue for you?
I think it's the my impressions in the more recent period really were the same, that it's a very effective way of having a chance to air your views. Your views probably may well go down in a screaming heap unless they're those of the majority, and generally my views weren't those of the majority, so it's at least a chance to sort of say something, and which probably, well, you wouldn't usually expect it to get in the minutes, because whatever you're on was probably not going to be the winning point of view, but at least you had a chance. The council certainly, I believe at least up until the end of last year when it was cut down in size, I don't know how it goes now, but council was increasingly the most the best opportunity you had to have a wild card point of view presented. In fact, I think it was speedily becoming the only opportunity that I think bias, and I suspect the board of the faculty, is becoming very structured and just weighed down with their agendas, and the processes were completely preventing any sort of anyone getting up and saying, well, you know, stop, what are we here for? Are we really doing the right thing? You know, let's stop and consider what we're doing. That virtually disappears, and it disappeared certainly from the faculty board here years ago, become very much a controlled against me. Council, I think, was the last, I'm sure was the last place in this last few years, the last place in the university where any views could be put up and people would have to listen to them, even though they might, no one might second them, or they might be badly knocked about in a vote.
What did you see as the major issues while you were there?
In the 74-75 period? Mm. I guess the student participation was the sort of thing that the students were demonstrating about there. The
financial constraints, perhaps?
Financial constraints, I don't think were, my recollection is that they weren't that tight then. I think that they became much more evident when Carmel came in as Vice-Chancellor about that time. Crawford, to I guess in the sense that they were both economists, and you tended to sort of be looking much more at strategic planning and costing of things than perhaps was the case when you didn't have an economist in thinking about those sort of things. But I don't believe in 74. I think 74, 75, they were into the stage of looking at clawing back one or a couple of percent of funds generally to start up new things, but there wasn't the certainly wasn't anything like the financial worries or constraints that were there, say, in the last 3 or 4 years, the second time when I was on. No, so the salad days may have finished by then, but the realisation that they'd finished hadn't hit people.
Can we come back to the school then? And we last left more or less when Fenner was coming in. And,
right.
And then, of course, there were three directors before the first outside director, Bob Porter.
Right.
Did the change from one director to another, I mean Fenner, Cortis and Gibson, have much of a direct impact, do you think, on the school?
Probably not. Cortis was, as you know, was a keen sort of runner for the position when Fenner got it. When he eventually became director, it was too late. I mean, he was only for about 2 years, and it's hard to say. He would have, I think he probably would have been better as director. I'm sure he would have been better as director if he got it when Fenner got it, rather than when he got it virtually 2 years off his retirement.
So he saw himself more or less as a caretaker.
Sure. Yeah. He was. I can remember the when he moved out of pathology, which is this was half of his office here, and moved down to there. The first council meeting after this, Pansy Wright got stuck into the electoral committee for the professorship of pathology and raised the point that Cortis shouldn't be on it because he was just leaving the position. I remember telling Cortis about this after the council meeting. I'll resign with this bloody job if that's the sort of thing. It's Pansy Wright. I think it was Pansy Wright having a dig at Cortis that they used to. I think he always wanted to do that on occasion. No, it was very much just keeping the ship, keeping the keel straight. And Frank Gibson, I don't know. I suspect you presumably will talk with him about his period. I doubt that it was something that he'd sort of coveted and hankered after and really wanted. I don't know how much pressure was put on him to take it, but he had a fairly tough time when he started because he couldn't. He finished up having to run his department at the same time he was director because the person who was next most senior wouldn't take it on unless he was made a professor, I understand. And so Gibson finished up.
Who was that?
John Morrison, who he spoke with after the meeting there. I think that's probably pretty accurate, but Gibson could confirm it or say it isn't, wasn't quite like that. But the outcome was that Gibson was almost the director who never was because he carried on and did, which may well be the way the directorship could be handled, because he carried on and did his full activities, experimental activities and everything around in the lab, but much the same way as Ian Young's doing now, but the difference that he's taken on sort of for 12 or 18 months just to fill the position in for them. And okay, he's obviously keeping his own going. Frank Gibson took it on. I'm sure there must have been, he must have had the idea that he didn't really want the thing because he took it on for only a 3-year term, which is when you think back, and I mean, it's normally offered for 7 years or 6 years as a negotiated term, but the fact he took it for 3 years, I assume that he said, well, I'm not getting out of science, I'll take it on for that period, then it's someone else's turn.
And then, at the end of that 3-year period, or even a little bit before, he got out of it with expedition.
He got out of it with expedition. He got out of it. I mean, he would head back to the. I don't know that he ever, however, completely moved into the director's office. He used to work back and scuttle around to his old laboratory around there in his office. I think most of the time, because he was, as he was still acting, head of the department. And I mean, this is harks back to what we're talking about last time about Fleury's letter to someone that's mentioned in McFarlane's biography. The trouble with ANU is that they don't realise that their position of directorship of the school isn't at all appealing to a practising scientist. Yeah. And I mean, Frank Gibson exemplified that to a T, taken it on, and he got out of a jolly pass when the opportunity offered. And but I guess certainly he didn't take it on. And again, you can confirm this talking with him. I would think he didn't see himself as having or wanting a mandate for really guarnamento, sort of looking at the thing and standing back and rearranging it all, the type of activity. It was very much like a continuation of Curtis, keeping the ship running. It's been running okay, and that's the way to go. So I guess that possibly in retrospect one could see some danger coming up there. The other feature of that period, which is the feature of the school before that and right up until very recently, was the 1978 review of this school, which is remarkable, and they always are, in the sense that they produced a confidential report. But the confidential report was, you were called in and had the piece that related to you read out. Start here, finish here. Which I think was incredible even then. I mean, now it looks like you think it's the last century or something, but it's this history for secrecy. I don't know the reasons why it was kept as secret as it was. The 78 report was the one which recommended phasing out of experimental pathology, and because there'd been a number of attempts to fill the chair here. The first time, Curtis obviously stayed on the committee despite Pansy Wright bringing up that Pansy Wright used to call him Fred. Fred would call him Curtis. Pansy would call it, was referred to him as Fred, which Curtis sort of hated.
What did Curtis
call him? Colin Curtis, sorry. I don't know, right. But anyhow, they may have crossed the swords at some stage. But the first attempt to fill the chair, they had a guy called Holzer, who in fact was sunk by a reference from Henry Harris at once. So this is a reference that some of the troops reckoned that Holzer didn't look too good. How